Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Hey fans, Lindsay Cortez, host of the podcast and sports dietitian. I'm here today with Dr. Caitlin Alexander, PT, DPT, CAFS. Caitlin is a physical therapist, multi-sport coach, Ironman triathlete based out of Boulder, Colorado. She holds a doctorate in physical therapy and certification in applied functional science from the Gray Institute. Caitlin currently works as a physical therapist, bike fitter, and run gait analyst at Build Sports Performance Lab in Louisville, Colorado. She enjoys being able to help athletes reach their goals on multiple levels, whether it's curating a rehab plan to recover from an injury or analyzing an athlete's running mechanics to make performance gains. Caitlin is also an elite amateur triathlete and will be competing at the Ironman World Championships in Kona, Hawaii this fall. Caitlin, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited to dig into your work, but also just you as an athlete yourself. And as before we hit record, you were telling me you just had a training session. I see you actively refueling on this call. I love that.
Yes. I made the smoothie really quick before I hopped on my computer. So trying to get rehydrated and get that protein intake right after. So
perfect. I love it. I do the same thing too with my clients. It's like, well, we've got to practice what we preach. If we're going to run around, like you have to make time for fueling, busy schedules. I know endurance training takes so much out of your day, but you can eat and be on a podcast at the same time.
Agreed. Yeah. And I have a swim session this afternoon too. So I'm like, trying to make sure that I'm, staying, just kind of keeping that calorie intake up throughout the day. So
let's kind of start this conversation with your journey as an athlete. I mean, you have Kona coming up really soon. When did you first get into triathlons?
So I got into the sport probably like in high school. So that's, I don't even know how long ago, maybe 15 years ago or so, 15, 20 years ago. And I grew up swimming. My parents put me and my siblings in swim lessons growing up. And then I ran cross country a little bit throughout middle school and high school. But I was always getting injured running and I started to really hate it. And so where I was from in Virginia, they started a couple of these youth sprint triathlons. And so me and my sister decided to sign up because we knew how to swim, we ran, and we also knew how to ride a bike. And so that was kind of my first foray into the sport. And I loved it. I just loved the variety and, having three different elements to train for and, not having to run every single day. And so I kind of did it a little bit throughout high school. And then I went to college and I think I was just a little burnout from like running and exercising and everything. So I didn't really do anything throughout throughout college. And then afterwards I was like, I kind of want to get back into it. So I took it a little bit more seriously. I joined a club in New York City where I lived at the time and, tried to be a little bit more competitive with it. And I signed up for my first Ironman when I was 25. And then, after I completed that, I realized that that is really where my passion was, the longer distance stuff, because I never had a ton of that like sharp, fast end speed, that fast twitch muscle fiber speed. But I could do really well at the longer endurance events. And so that was like kind of where I decided that was going to be my focus. And so since then, over the past 7-8 years, I've just been really working on trying to excel at the Ironman distance. And it really takes years to develop, you know, just that kind of mental toughness and also just to get all those miles into your legs. So I've been working on that the past 7-8 years and ended up qualifying for Kona in actually 2019, at the end of 2019. And it was supposed to be the Kona for 2020. And obviously that was canceled with the pandemic. And so it's been canceled every year since then. And so I've just been waiting since 2019 to finally do this race. And hopefully, fingers crossed, it's going to happen this fall.
For sure. Fingers crossed. So when did the race organization, race directors, like, notify people who have been on hold and waiting for the last few years that, like, hey, we're going to do it?
So I think they canceled in 2020, they canceled it pretty early on, like that spring, which was nice because we hadn't really booked a ton of our travel. And, you know, I hadn't really gotten into the big Ironman build for that. 2021, we thought it was going to happen and they ended up, so Kona's in October every year, the beginning of October. And I believe they canceled it towards the end of August. And so
we had done so much training.
I was kind of prepping for that. You know, we had our Airbnbs booked, we had our flights booked, everything. And so that was a big letdown. So far, I haven't heard anything this year. I think they're going to go through with it. Even if they don't, I'm still going to go to Hawaii and take a vacation because everything's already booked now. So,
yeah. Obviously, you've been doing this for years and you're constantly in a trained state, but we do go through training cycles. And so I'm just curious to know at, you know, for Ironman World Championships, like what is that training block to like really prepare for that? What does that look like for you as far as like how many months out are you like intentionally like, this is my Kona training?
Yeah, so the world championships are usually in either for 70.3 or the full Ironman distance, like later in the season. So usually October, I think the 70.3 world champs is the end of October this year. And so that's a really long season depending on how early you get started. And so you really need to be cognizant of the fact that you're taking like a mid-season break throughout because it's just not realistic to continually build throughout, you know, 7, 8, 9 months, you know, without getting injured or seriously increasing your risk for injury. So I definitely take an off season every year, just mentally and physically, like taking a break from needing to follow structured training. And that usually is, you know, 4 to 6 weeks or so, closer to 4. And I'm not just like sitting on the couch doing nothing, but I'm doing things outside of my normal swim, bike, run, whether it's like going for a hike or, you know, it's usually winter, you know, going cross country skiing or something like that. And then just to kind of stay active, because I also like just mentally don't do well with not being active, but just trying to give my mind and body a little bit of a break and a reset. And then I'll start back up, you know, the beginning of the year. And, you know, depending on what my season looks like, if I have a few shorter distance races early on in the year, start building for those. I usually try to do a full Ironman distance somewhat early in the season as almost like a prep. In the past couple of years, it's always, you know, I've been building for Kona, like that's my A race in the fall. And so I've been building on, you know, doing another Ironman distance race, you know, like June, like sometime earlier in the season, just to kind of get those Ironman legs under me and then take a little break after that and then do my second build towards Kona. So that's kind of what this season ideally would look like for me building for an Ironman World Championship event in the fall. So,
yeah, I think what you said about like, it's unrealistic to just push through training for 9 months and that a break has to be in there somewhere, a full 4 to 6 weeks. It doesn't mean you do nothing, but it means we're not doing intense training. We're doing other things. So that's awesome. And we're just like diving right into it. There's other things I want to ask you about, like being a physical therapist and stuff. But I think this is just such a, you know, when you're in the thick of it right now, you know, we're recording this at the end of July. And so it's coming up. So as you are preparing yourself with your physical training, what are some ways that you are also paying attention to your nutrition? Do you have any like guidelines that you personally like, goals, priorities of like, this is what I focus on to make sure that I'm fueling and recovering my body correctly?
Yeah, nutrition is a huge, huge component of endurance racing, especially as you get into the longer distances. And I always say for an Ironman or even just any triathlon in general, nutrition is the fourth discipline. So if you don't nail that, you're not going to have a great race. And so that's been, you know, over the years, even, you know, as I'm training to improve my swim, bike, and run, I've also been training to, you know, improve, you know, my carbohydrate intake or my electrolyte intake during the race, to find foods that work well with my GI system when I'm under stress, to figure out what my hydration needs need to look like, what my electrolyte intake needs to look like, depending on the weather for the race. So that's constantly something I'm thinking about when I'm training, just so that I have that nailed down and it's not like a shock to my system when I go into a race and I'm not used to fueling this way, or I'm not used to taking in this much fluids when I'm racing or things like that. And for a race like Kona, it's, you know, you really need to have a dialed in nutrition plan for that, just because the elements are just so harsh on the body with the heat and humidity. You need to know how much fluid you need to intake. You need to know how many grams of carbohydrates per hour you need to intake. You need to know what your electrolyte intake needs to look like, how much you sweat, the concentration of your sweat, things like that. And so for me, it's always, you know, I've tried out so many different types of like hydration drinks and foods, and I find that what works best for me is more on the simpler side. So I don't do well with like complex foods. I don't do well with things that have a strong taste when I'm racing, especially when it's hot. Cause when my body's under physiological stress, I like lose my appetite. And then if I lose my appetite, I don't eat when I race. And then that's just a disaster when I get off the bike and I try to run. It's not going to be a good race for me. So I have to find things that, you know, I won't feel like I'm going to gag up like when I'm like on the bike trying to eat food. And then, you know, just trying to find a hydration drink that has a good balance of carbohydrates and a good balance of electrolytes that doesn't make you thirstier when you drink it. Cause I've definitely had some hydration mixes that do that. And so, and I've tried out a bunch of things. I just did Ironman Des Moines the beginning of June, and I was using a drink mix for that I had been using for the past couple of years, and it was fine. But I realized, I don't know why I didn't realize this before, but it doesn't really have any electrolytes in it. And so, which was shocking to me. I don't know why I just didn't pick that up before. I usually always supplement with like some sort of electrolyte pill during the race too.
Mm-hmm, like a tablet.
Yeah. Just because otherwise I'll get off the bike or even on the bike, I'll start cramping towards the end. So I had been, you know, taking that in, but I guess it still wasn't enough. And during Ironman Des Moines, I have this little like salt tube that you like lick your thumb, you put it on the tube, you flip it over. So salt gets on your thumb and then you lick your thumb. So it's like, you actually get that salty taste, you know, on your tongue before it's even absorbed into your system. And I don't know what happened during the run, but I think I threw it out when I was trying to throw out a cup of fluid or something. And I realized after a couple miles, I didn't have it anymore. And I like almost panicked because it was like in the mid 90s, like 70% humidity. It was so hot and humid. And I was like, this is going to be a disaster. Like I don't have any other salt pills. They don't have salt pills at the aid stations. The gels that they had at the aid stations didn't have electrolytes in them. They only had Gatorade. And so I was like going to every aid station, just trying to take in as much like Gatorade, the only thing that had electrolytes in it. And I ended up like being okay. I like warded off any like potential cramping during that race. But after that, I was like, okay, I need to really, you know, take a second look at my nutrition and figure out, you know, if I'm using the best thing for me. So I've been experimenting with a couple other brands that have a higher salt, like sodium intake, just because I know I'm a salty sweater. I've had a sweat test done. My dad's the same way. So it's kind of genetic. So I've just since then been experimenting with a couple different types of hydration products and yeah, just kind of in prep for Kona to figure out what works best.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We are actually with my clients. I just launched what I'm calling an alumni group, which is like once you've been a client of mine in any one of my programs or any way or form, like an alumni group where we're just continuing to like push each other forward. And our topic this month was hydration. And we were doing similar, because it sounds, everybody's like, oh, drink water. Like, okay, but it's so much more, like, it's more complicated than that. It's a lot more complicated, especially for performance. And so I was teaching them about sweat rate testing and really dialing that in. It is helpful when you're training to understand what your sweat rate is, what you need, and to match your sodium needs to that. And I've already, we did this alumni group. We did our deep dive hydration talk a little over a week ago. And as the girls and women in the program are practicing and challenging themselves to what I taught them over the past week, all of them have commented of like, I didn't realize how much sodium and how many electrolytes I needed. And now they're doing it and they're feeling, oh yeah, I actually did recover great. And my workout the next day felt really great.
Yeah.
And so it makes a huge difference.
A huge difference. And especially in the summer here in Colorado, I mean, it's hot, it's super dry, you're at high altitude. So especially if I have like multiple training sessions a day, I am always rehydrating with some sort of electrolyte like substance in my water, just because I know I'm, even if it's, you know, I'm not sweating as much as I would look like I am in a humid environment, but I am sweating a lot. And so I don't realize, I think, how much salt I'm losing. So yeah, I'm always cognizant of that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. And yeah, I think another reason that you touched on already is that if dehydration comes into play, then we're going to lose our appetite, or then our stomach actually doesn't work, like digestion doesn't work as well. So then you either aren't eating enough, or when you do eat, you're not digesting it well. And that's when we start to run into gut issues. And I mean, this is probably, this affects us no matter what type of athlete we are, what sport, but definitely in these endurance sports. And I think I've heard this before. I've never competed at Kona, and this trajectory that my life is taking, I don't think I ever will. But like, that's what I've heard from other people before, is it's swim, run, bike, or I know I said that backwards, swim, bike, run, and nutrition, because the fueling piece will make or break that day for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you'll learn pretty quickly on in the sport, you know, if you don't have that piece dialed in, you're not going to be successful. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing some of those tips to other people who are interested in the triathloning. And I think just that focus on hydration is really important. Energy, yes, but heat, humidity, and we're in the summertime right now. You're training through the summer to gear up for that. And Kona is a hot and humid environment. So also just like that preparation of like, doesn't matter where you live, you have to start preparing your body for what the elements are going to be like on race day.
Yeah, exactly. So. Exactly.
Yeah. So you started triathloning actually in high school. You've been doing that for a while. And then of course you became a physical therapist along the way. At what point though, did that become your like, I want to do this for a career? Cause it wasn't always right away.
Yeah, definitely. It's a second career for me. So I majored in music in undergrad, which is so funny. People are always surprised when I say that, because I really don't do anything with music now except sing in my shower. I moved to New York City after college to work in the music industry. So that's what I was doing for a couple years. And I hated it. It's not as glamorous as it looks from the outside. And so
yeah.
I was kind of at this crossroads in my life where I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I, you know, was really getting competitively into the sport of triathlon. And I loved it. And I started coaching as well. And then I feel like this is every kind of PT's story of how they get into the profession. But I was biking home from the gym one day in Manhattan, and I got doored by a cab, which is, yeah. So now I never ride close to parked cars. So it was just a really unlucky like scenario. I was at the wrong place at the wrong time, and I ended up tearing a couple ligaments in my knee and undergoing surgery. And, you know, that was my first experience with PT. I'd never been to a physical therapist before. My dad's a physician, so, and a runner. So anytime I had any issues, I would always kind of consult him. And so I love working with athletes, you know, as a coach, and I grew up dancing. So I loved like human movement and analyzing it. And so I was like, this is such a cool profession. And I kind of made a decision at that point that you know, even though I didn't have any prereqs from undergrad, that I was just going to like quit my job, go back to school, take some prereqs for a couple of years, and then apply to school. And that's what happened. And so applied for PT school out in Colorado and I got in, and that's how I ended up in Colorado. And so, yeah, it's been kind of a whirlwind experience over the last 10 years, but I love what I do every day, and I like wouldn't change anything about the path that I went on. So,
yeah. Hey fans, I hope you are enjoying this conversation so far, and we'll be back to it in just a moment. But first, I want to pause and let you know that this episode is brought to you by the Female Athlete System of Transformation, aka the Fast Track to overcome disordered eating and use food as fuel to perform at your highest level. The Female Athlete System of Transformation is my unique program and proven systems to guide female athletes to understanding and implementing the proper nutrition for their sport, life, and health. Myself and my team of registered sports dietitians work one-on-one with clients to address their unique needs and counsel them through the nutritional and behavioral changes needed. Many female athletes who resonate with disordered eating, mental guilt around food and body, relative energy deficiency in sport or female athlete triad, amenorrhea, repeat injuries due to negligent nutrition, or frankly, just a lack of knowledge and understanding on their fueling needs, have seen incredible success in the Fast Track. After years of working as a sports RD, I've compiled the most effective ways for female athletes to learn nutrition, be supported, be challenged, and ultimately find their success with fueling as fast as possible. So don't wait another day. Get to your goals faster by joining the Female Athlete System of Transformation. Look in the show notes or head to the website to book a free call and learn more. Okay, now let's get you back to the conversation. Enjoy. No, it's great to hear. I think it's great to hear when, like, just for people who are younger, because it's really difficult to figure out what you want to do right away. Right. And it's like, it's okay if you change your mind and you can't go back to school. And even though, like, to go from music to suddenly pursuing physical therapy meant you had a lot of schooling to do. So I'm sure that was really difficult and, you know, a big challenge, a financial challenge, like everything. But it is possible, and it worked out in the end. And so with being a physical therapist, and being in Colorado, where just like your demographic is, you work with a lot of athletes, correct?
I do. Yes.
And then you also, and when I read your bio, you do like bike fitting and run gait analysis, but these are not necessarily skills that every physical therapist has, or no?
Yeah, they're not, especially the bike fitting. And I think, you know, in PT school, we had maybe a couple lectures on running gait analysis, but it was never super in depth. And there was no like technology involved, or, you know, it was just kind of video capture stuff. But where I work now is a pretty amazing clinic, and there aren't a lot of other clinics like that. We're a physical therapy clinic first and foremost. We also have a biomechanics lab. So we do kind of 3D motion capture, gait analysis, walking and running. And then we have a bike fitting lab as well. So we do bike fits, both medical and performance bike fits. So I love it. It's kind of like a nice blend of, you know, it's not like I go into the clinic and do PT all day, every day. It's like I see my patients, I do a couple bike fits, I do a couple running gait analysis. And it's just a really nice blend. And I feel like we can really more holistically treat that athlete, especially if it's a cyclist or a triathlete that's, you know, doing multiple different sports, being able to kind of see things from all sides of the picture. You know, I've had triathletes, I think, are notoriously some of the most challenging clients to work with, just because there are three different sports involved. And so, you know, if you have issues with your bike fit, but it's manifesting as pain on the run, you know, you need to be familiar with like all three sports and the demands of the three sports to be able to treat them effectively, in my opinion. And so it's nice that we, you know, I can have a patient come in. I get cyclists that come in sometimes and they're like, you know, I'm having like back pain. You know, I only really feel it on the bike. And, it, you know, after I bike or go for a ride, it like hurts the rest of the day. And so you know, we're addressing their pain in the treatment room, you know, with manual therapy or exercise or things like that, but it's just not resolving, then I'm like, okay, well, let's actually see what you look like on the bike, because we could be doing all the work in the clinic, but if something about your bike fit is not setting you up for success, then it's all, you know, just counterproductive. And so it's nice that I can kind of get them in on the bike and see what factors may be contributing to, you know, their presentation. So.
Yeah, that's great. And I imagine the same thing with the run gait analysis. It's like you can be doing the work in the PT clinic and doing all your exercises, mobility, strengthening things. But then if you go run for an hour and your mechanics are off, like that's, I don't know if it's a direct undoing of all the work, but potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. There could just be certain things with, you know, and I'm always so cautious about, you know, changing running mechanics, because I always say that, you know, the body optimizes its movement based on its physical and functional constraints. So if you're not addressing some of those constraints and you're just trying to, like, you know, tell them to change a certain aspect of their running gait, you're probably not going to get very far. But, you know, certain things like cadence or overstriding or things that we know in the literature are linked to increased injury risk, things like that, that can be easily fixed with like a couple cues, can go a long way. So,
yeah, I was writing that down, cadence and overstriding. Yeah. and I'm wondering I feel like most people understand what overstriding is, and we can imagine that and understand why that leads to injuries where, you know, maybe heel striking more or something like that. But with cadence, like, can you first, I know what that is, but if you could give a definition to other listeners as to what cadence is and how, in what way, too fast, too slow, like in what ways is that contributing to injuries?
Yeah. So cadence is the number of steps you take per minute, and it's super variable from person to person and depends on so many different factors like your height. You know, if you're 6'3" versus someone who's 5', your leg length is probably going to be different, and the steps per minute you take are probably going to be different. It can depend on, you know, even like your leg stiffness or your tendon stiffness. So if you don't have good stiffness in your tendons and you just really can't get off the ground quickly, then your cadence is probably going to be a little bit lower. You know, how bouncy of a runner you are impacts your cadence as well. But cadence and overstriding can be linked. Overstriding is essentially, it means that your foot lands in far in front of your body center of mass. So again, it can also be a result of many different factors like your knee drive, having a low cadence, having a really high bounce, or what we call vertical oscillation, or running too upright. And so then you're kind of striking out too far in front of you. So these factors may not necessarily be related to something like strength or stability or like motor control, like things that we can really address with, like, you know, exercise or neuromuscular reeducation or things like that. But just a couple simple cues can help dial some of those factors into a safe range. I mean, cadence, like I said before, is a pretty variable metric. And I know that there are some people out there that are, say, 180 steps per minute. That's how many steps you should take. But I never, you know, I'm never trying to make someone, you know, run at a cadence that's too high for their body or too low. Actually, I don't think I've ever had any runner come in that I say you need to decrease your cadence. But ideally, you know, there does come a point where if you're trying to increase your cadence too much and you're not spending enough time on the ground to really like absorb enough energy to release it, then that can be also, that can just negatively impact your performance. So cadence is a sensitive variable. And obviously, you know, if you're someone who comes in and runs at, you know, 150 steps per minute, which for all you listeners out there is pretty low, that's some of the lowest cadence metrics I've seen in the gait lab, then, you know, working on trying to have them increase it to 160 can be a huge jump. You know, if someone comes in with a cadence of 155 and I'm like, you should be running at 180, like that huge jump is going to probably cause more harm than good. So, you know, you really need to work with the runner to meet them where they are and, you know, work on those small steps of improvement. And I always give this example, but I had a runner come in once who was seeing another PT at my clinic, and just to address some, like, I think it was bilateral hip pain and shin pain that they had been having. And, you know, the PT consulted me and she was like, you know, I I just don't really see anything in the treatment room, like with the exam, that like a reason why he would be having this pain when he's running. Like, can you do a gait analysis with him and really figure out what's going on? And I was like, absolutely. And so we got him on the treadmill. We got him set up with our marker system. And I found that his cadence was so low. I believe it was 156. And his vertical oscillation or his bounce, like how high he bounces, was so high. It was like 12 or 13 centimeters, which is pretty high. That's some of the highest numbers we see. And so even though he was strong, like the kind of force he was putting into his body with each step was so large that it was just too much for his body to handle. So at a certain point in every run, you know, things would break down and he would start having pain. And so that's a really good example of how you can make like subtle changes with someone, you know, almost immediately to address some of these issues and just take stress off of the system.
Yeah. He was getting some volleyball type injuries running like that.
I was like, I don't know. And I get some runners who come in who have a really bouncy style of gait. And oftentimes they did play like ballistic sports growing up, like basketball or soccer or things like that. And so that's just how they have developed like their running style. So that's always interesting too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, but once you start putting on the miles, then it's going to start, and the time into it. Yeah. It's going to start causing those injuries. So I think you just shed a lot of light on some like common biomechanical issues that are often seen, and your skill set there of being able to look like do the bike fitting and the gait analysis. And I know there's another skill set that you have that I have a little bit of experience with on the client end of things, of dry needling. And I don't think that I've touched on this with other physical therapists that we've had on the podcast, even though some of them may have been trained in this. But yeah, I just haven't talked about it yet on this podcast. So dry needling is a technique that you are like certified in. And I know it kind of varies state to state so in Colorado as a physical therapist, are you allowed to practice this?
Yes, we are. I think we were one of the first states to implement it in our practice act.
Mm-hmm. So could you, since I've never talked about it on the podcast, can you share with listeners, what is dry needling? When would you use it?
Yes, and I want to hear about your experience with it too, but I'll explain it just a little bit. So dry needling is, I always equate it a little bit to acupuncture, but it's pretty different. So we use the same needle. It's like a very, very thin monofilament needle, and we insert it directly into muscle tissue. So acupuncture is a little different in that I believe, this is from my understanding, that it follows the meridian lines of the body versus dry needling. You know, we're more Western medicine and we actually follow the anatomy and in physiology. So, you know, we're going into muscles, we're needling near nerves to stimulate nerves, things like that. And it has evolved to be more than just inserting a needle into a trigger point. So initially dry needling was called trigger point dry needling. And that was because, you know, you want to insert that needle into a trigger point, which is essentially that motor band in a tissue that really impacts the way that muscle can slide and glide as it contracts. And that needle would release that trigger point. But now we actually call it functional dry needling because we have learned that there is so much more involved with even your nervous system than just impacting that trigger point. So first and foremost, I always want to preface with any kind of manual modality. I do a lot of manual work in the clinic, but I also do a lot of like exercise and strength training type stuff. With a manual modality like dry needling, it will never fix an injury. And so sometimes people will go to see a PT or go to see a chiropractor and they'll get dry needling done, but then there's nothing followed up. There's no like, you know, re-educating proper movement patterns, loading a muscle, things like that. And so the dry needling can temporarily make things feel better, but you're not actually changing anything with the system. And so pain can come back, tightness can come back, things like that. So I think that's one reason why what we do in the clinic is a little bit different than maybe other clinics. And one of the PTs where I work is a dry needling instructor. And she teaches dry needling all across the US and Canada. So I feel very lucky to have her in the clinic as just a resource.
Yeah.
So when it comes to dry needling, it can be really effective at reducing symptoms and stimulating your nervous system. So if someone comes in with pain and you know, we just cannot effectively load that tissue because it is so hyperactive and they're just in like a sympathetic nervous system, like a fight or flight state. The dry needling can be a really effective way to get things to calm down so that we can actually load the tissue effectively. There is really good research in the literature to support doing dry needling with electrical stimulation. So, you know, if you've ever used like a TENS unit, you know, with the pads that get the muscles to contract, it's similar to that. So we're basically sending an electrical current into the muscle itself through the needle. And then we're getting that muscle to contract and we're actually stimulating that neuromuscular junction and your nervous system. So it almost provides this kind of like neurophysiological reset. And I always equate it to like jump starting a car, although that image is always like really intense. It's not quite like that. There's no like electrocution.
Well, in my experience, I honestly want to say, yeah, that's a great metaphor there because that was my experience with it too.
Yeah. So, you know, if typically injured tissue, you know, there is almost this kind of shutdown that happens with our central nervous system. And so when things hurt, we tend to not give that part of the body as much attention or as much space in our brain just because we don't want to use it. You know, if something hurts, we don't want to use it. And so typically injured tissue hasn't had good input from the nervous system in a while. And so the dry needling with the electrical stim can be a really great way to just re-educate that muscle and that neuromuscular connection and almost kind of reteach it how it's supposed to function. So I'll see like immediate strength changes before and after dry needling when we did no like muscle activation, no exercise, like nothing. So it's a pretty powerful tool if you use it the right way and you follow up with, you know, re-educating the body on those proper movement patterns, loading the tissue so that it gets stronger, things like that.
Yeah, I agree. As being somebody who received it, like it's not something I do now or need now, but when I needed it, the first time I got it, I was like, this is magic. I didn't know that physical therapy, because like, I just didn't know that was possible to see so much results so quickly. I found that after, and I did do the dry needling with the electrical stimulation. I think the short story is between being a gymnast and a hurdler and having two surgeries on both ankles, my calves are chronically tight. And back in 2016, I had another ankle surgery that as I was rehabbing from, and then when I started to get back into running, my calves were just bricks all the time. And I was working with a physical therapist. A lot of it had to do with my ankle mobility was not good. We were working, and then she was trained in dry needling. She did one session of dry needling with electrical stimulation. It was like jumpstarting a car and it hurt. And I felt that entire week, I felt like 70% of my issues were resolved after literally one session. And we did a few more sessions and then I continued with the appropriate physical therapy, strengthening, ankle mobility things that I needed to do. And it was, I mean, I don't know how many sessions I did. I probably did like 10 sessions total, but it changed the game for me because I was having years of issues with my calves and the surgery rehab stuff. So it was like, I was blown away when I was introduced. I was calling my dad. I was like, you got to do this.
I love that you had a great experience with that. It sounds like it was, you know, your PT knew what he or she was doing. And so that's why you were successful. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And I just want to add to this story because it goes off of what you were saying about the pain and like the almost like neuromuscular refiring, because I got this treatment when I was working on a military base, and actually it was in Florida, and I don't think Florida allows dry needling, but on a military base you can.
I'm not sure about Florida.
And yeah, maybe things have changed, so I don't want to misspeak, but definitely in the US military, they can do it and use it. And so they were using it on a lot of the military because when you think about injuries, that yeah, it's a physical injury, but so much is also linked to our brain and how we're perceiving pain or memories we associate to that. And so that treatment was really useful in the military population to I don't know. It was like, I'm not going to speak on it that great, but just like, it's not just about the physical body. It was about the brain's connection and releasing of the pain.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, the brain controls everything, and even the pain signals that we get from, you know, different parts of our body go to the brain. And so how the brain perceives that can really impact how you feel pain. So that's why, you know, any kind of modality that can impact your nervous system, you're really going to get more bang for your buck, for sure.
And that's why the dry needling was so important in that population and many others, is because it was impacting the nervous system.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can absolutely see that, for sure, especially for like chronic pain and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, very cool. So hopefully some people just learned a few things about dry needling. I think it's one of the coolest things. If a state allows a physical therapist to do it, I'm like, I just think it's one of the coolest. It's one, there's so many things you can do, but that's like, to me, that's like the new and shiny thing. Yeah,
it is. And it's also like, I work in a cash-based clinic. So, you know, we're out of network, which means we don't have contracts with insurance companies for many reasons I could go into, but I'm not going to. But, you know, so our clientele, they pay out of pocket when they come in to see us. And so they're expecting results, you know, after the first session, and they're dedicated because they're paying out of pocket and they want to get better. And so you really, like, working in that kind of environment, you really need to be able to make a change after that first session. And so that's where dry needling can be incredibly beneficial, because you do see that change immediately. It's not like you're going to go home and then a week you might feel better, you know, after doing some of these exercises. It's like being able, in pre and post testing is something we do, like something I do with every patient, but being able to see a change pre and post treatment session is pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. So if you're down for having a ton of needles, the first time I got it done, I was like taking pictures of my leg. I was like, I can't believe what's happening. And it was hooked up to the electrical stimulation. It was crazy. And yeah, it was painful too. I was biting my fingers. Like,
I will say the calves are some of the more painful areas to dry needle, because people that need it in the calves have a ton of tension in those calf muscles. And so it just, you feel more when that needle goes in. But there are definitely other areas of the body where you don't feel it as much. But the calves definitely, and the calves can get really sore after too.
Yeah, I was sore for a couple of days. But yeah, I'm like trying to relive that experience right now. That was really painful, I'm remembering. But it worked, so it was worth it.
Yes,
but
yes.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, awesome. Well, Caitlin, I end every podcast with the same questions for every guest. I've got four more questions for you. You ready?
Sure.
If you could eat one food every single day for the rest of your life, but never get sick of it, what would it be?
Oh my God. I think that is like the hardest question I've ever been asked recently. Oh my gosh. I don't even know what that would be. I would say maybe pizza, because we eat pizza a lot here, and you can be super variable with what you put on it. And, you know, but, I don't know if I would ever get tired of that. Maybe I would, but I don't know. I'm going to go with pizza.
I think that sounds like a great answer.
Awesome.
I love it. Sounds obvious, but it might not be. What's your favorite sport to participate in?
I'm going to go with rugby. No, I'm just kidding. I'm going to go with triathlon. Triathlon, but it's three different sports, but I think I can count that as one sport.
Yeah. It's technically one. Yeah.
Awesome.
And how about as a spectator? What do you like being a fan of watching?
I actually, this is pretty relevant right now, I love watching track and field. And with the world championships going on right now, that's what we've been doing every night. And my boyfriend is a track runner, and he's like I think it's called middle distance. He does like the mile and 3K and stuff. But you were a hurdler, so you did track. But
yeah.
But yeah, I never really, you know, I did track for a year in high school, I think, and that was my really only experience with the sport. But you know, going to his track meets and watching them run, it is, and even the field events too, like watching like the discus and the shot put and javelin is like, and even like the jumpers too, like long jump and triple jump, so much fun to watch. And I don't know what it is about being in that kind of environment where, you know, all eyes are on you 100% of the time. And like, you really get to see like humanity like at play there, you know, people struggling, people fighting, people persevering. And it's been, especially on the world stage, it's been so much fun to watch. So
yeah, I agree. I love that answer. And I've just got this big smile because I agree with you. I feel like it's, and I've been watching some people's like social media stories of watching the world championships and like kind of making jokes about like, we're watching people run and turn left, but it's like, but it's so fun.
It's like, so much really, more than that. Like, I didn't realize how
we're watching
much
people run and jump. It's like, it's a big deal.
I know. And even the runners, like, I didn't realize how much like tactic and strategy was involved in some of these events. And it's just like, you know, it's not just about your pure talent and your speed, but about how you execute a race, which I guess you could say that about any sport, but still. Yeah.
It's been fun. I guess you can, but I'm with you. I love watching track and field. Yeah. So that's awesome. Last question, Caitlin, if there's a female athlete out there that you want to give a shout out to, somebody well-known or in your personal life that you think is just an inspirational role model or somebody who is fierce, fit, and fueled, who would that be and why?
That is a really great question. I think I'm going to go a little more personal, and I'm going to give a shout out to actually one of my friends here in Boulder and who is also one of my patients. So I've really seen kind of the depths of what she's been going through over the past couple years. But her name's Rachel Olson. Some of you might know her. She's a professional triathlete here in Boulder. And she just underwent like a cartilage repair, like a knee surgery last fall. And so I helped kind of rehab her back from that, from, you know, day one when she couldn't weight bear and was on crutches to the point where she just got third. She placed third at the 70.3 Ironman Mont Tremblant in Canada a couple weeks ago. And just to see like her resilience and, you know, how much fight she's put into getting herself back on that starting line has been so motivating for me. And even just to see, you know, how she handled everything over the past couple years, because I think she was diagnosed with this cartilage defect in her knee like 2 years ago or so. And so when you have something like that, there's really no amount of conservative treatment you can do to change like that kind of that process in the knee. And so she was pretty much at a standstill with her training for probably almost 2 years, just like not knowing if she should get the surgery, you know. She wants to be, you know, she wants to do well at the sport. She wants to jump into Ironman distance and just being like in limbo for that long, still trying to train, still trying to do the best she could, having people doubt her along the way that she would ever like come back and be a successful professional and, you know, have her just kind of block all of that out, you know, go through the surgery, push all the haters and the doubters aside and prove them all wrong. So that's been pretty inspiring just to watch her throughout that whole journey. And, you know, it just inspires me to like keep working hard and keep trying my best. So
yeah, absolutely. For yourself and for all of your patients. So
yeah.
Also shout out to Rachel Olson, and thank you so much, Caitlin, for sharing your wisdom, your experiences, and wishing you the best as you finish up your training and go compete at Kona this fall.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed that episode and thanks for listening. But before I let you go, I have free resources that you can have access to right away, right now, so that you can start fueling your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. First, I have your Red S recovery race. If you've ever wondered if you might be struggling with Red S, curious to learn more, or know you have Red S and are looking to recover fast, then you can head to www.riseupnutritionrun.com/Red S and download the Red S recovery race. See how you place and figure out the next steps to recovery. Plus, while there, I have a few other great resources for you, including 3 nutrition secrets that every elite athlete swears by, and access to our private Facebook community, Female Athlete Nutrition. So again, to gain access to all of this, head to riseupnutritionrun.com/reds. That's /REDS. And you can gain access and get the help you need fast. Too many girls and women and female athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. Become Fierce, Fit, and Fueled. Links in the show notes, and I'll see you next time.